Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Hey there, podcast listeners. Matthew Winner here. For over 2 years now, I've been your host of the Let's Get Busy podcast, bringing you interviews with kidlit notables, award winners, and up-and-comers. People like Cece Bell, author and illustrator of El Defo, a graphic novel which not only stands as a testament to the power in storytelling through comics, but also garnered Cece a Newbery honor. And illustrator Matthew Cordell, whose deeply personal and absolutely beautiful picture book, Wish, along with stories Matt shared that led him to writing Wish, struck a chord with so many of you, myself included. Through your enthusiasm and your support, this podcast has been able to reach new audiences and, in some cases, new guests that make it feel less like an interview and more like a dinner party with several hundred of my best friends. Many of you have asked if there's anything you can do to support this podcast, and it turns out there is. I've installed a donate tab on the podcast homepage, and this month, I want to challenge you to consider what this podcast and these conversations have meant to you. And then, I want you to think about donating $1 or $2. Because of bandwidth and monthly subscription fees, it cost me about $5 per episode to put Let's Get Busy on the air. And beyond that, there's the time involved in recording and editing and getting the content ready to post. And I love doing it. I love this podcast. Each guest feels immediately like a friend, and I hope you feel like you're right there with us during these chats. I come at each weekly conversation with a slew of questions and a fair share of fanboy nerding out, and I plan to maintain this sincere and enthusiastic approach as we move into the third year of Let's Get Busy. And because of the podcast's success, I've been able to bring you more chats each month, in addition to starting The Best Book Ever This Week, which is a semi-weekly book review mini-episode. So, here's your opportunity to help out if you feel like it's the right thing to do for you and the right time to do it. And if it is the right time, or it's not, well, let me just say thank you again for listening. So, thank you. Okay, let's get busy. Welcome to Let's Get Busy, a weekly podcast where I talk shop and get down to business with authors, illustrators, kidlit notables, and everyone in between. I'm Matthew Winner, an elementary school librarian, author of the Busy Librarian blog, and your host. This is episode number 166 with Matt Tavares, author-illustrator most recently of Growing Up Pedro, which is published by Candlewick. Matt's work is gorgeous, and his art has contributed to some of the most beautiful picture books. And I certainly don't hesitate telling him so during our chat either. Numerous times. I hope you enjoy the listen and allow yourself to be a fan of his distinct artistic talents and his ability to share a great story. Here is episode number 166 of the podcast with Matt Tavares. Let's get busy. Welcome to the Let's Get Busy podcast, Matt Tavares. I'm excited to finally be talking to you, man.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
It's been a while. I think the first time we really started connecting was when I was seeing pictures of the boat that had your Pedro books on it
Oh, yes.
Did not quite get delivered.
Yeah, that was a bit of an ordeal, but they made it finally.
Yay, and what a great book it is, too. I'm so excited to get to talk about Growing Up Pedro. I love your art. I warned you that I'm going to fanboy. I'm going to try to keep my fanboy under control here. But
okay.
I love the stuff that you do, and the art you've created for Growing Up Pedro is beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm excited to talk about it. Why don't we just lead with that? Tell, if you don't mind, the story of Growing Up Pedro. What is this book?
Sure. It's a picture book biography of Pedro Martinez, who's about to be elected, or he was elected. He's about to be inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And it really just tells the story of him and his older brother, Ramon, and how they grew up in the Dominican Republic, both dreaming of making it to the big leagues. And it's mostly about Pedro, but it really is about these two brothers who really helped each other and sort of together pursued this dream of being big league baseball players. So it sort of takes him right up from his childhood up to his heyday in the big leagues.
Now, did researching this book mean that you got to have any sort of contact with Pedro?
It actually didn't. I had this I had this hope from the beginning that I'd get in touch with him and he'd be all excited about it and he'd be a big part of it. But right at the first 10 minutes of that, it kind of got squashed because I got in touch with his agent, actually like the marketing director for his agent, this guy Caesar. And he got right back to me saying, basically, like, they were cool with me making the book, but Pedro had just signed a book deal for his memoir, and he couldn't actually help with my book. So,
even if it's picture book versus like an adult
memoir.
I
tried to make that case that, my book and their book would even kind of help each other. You know, if someone is going to the store to buy the grown-up book, they might see my book and vice versa, you know.
Imagine that experience of being able to go to a store and, whomever dad's interested in this memoir of Pedro Martinez and gets to get a book with
his kid to share
and
hopefully that is happening with the two books because his book is out now as well. He was basically, he said there's a non-compete clause and they wanted to be really careful about that. So Pedro didn't have any direct involvement in the making of this book, which turned out to be fine. Like, he's done so many interviews over the years.
Yeah.
You know, anything I needed to find, I was pretty much able to get. It just, I had to do a little more digging than, there were certainly times where I wished I could have just texted him and asked about something, instead of having to like find all these different sources to figure out what's accurate.
So but, what drew you to, I know that you love baseball, but what drew you to telling Pedro's story?
Well, it really just started as, as a Red Sox fan, I had all these great memories of being at Fenway Park and watching Pedro pitch. And at the time, I didn't really think of him as this, this sort of figure within the history of baseball. He was just this, great pitcher I got to go see at Fenway. And really just, it was 3 years ago, I started just kind of looking back and just remembering just how special that was. Like, being at Fenway Park when he was pitching during those years, the whole place turned into a different place. Like, there were Dominican flags all over the crowd, and there were, people with the K signs for the strikeouts. And I just thought it'd be fun to try to capture that in a book. So then I started reading everything I could find about him, because I really didn't know his story beyond, by the time I knew him, he was the, Cy Young Award winner that the Red Sox just signed. And, he's a big star. But once I started reading about his childhood and his story and found this this connection with him and his brother, I really got excited about telling that story and putting it in a picture book.
Well, I'm glad you did, because it's a beautiful picture book. And Matt, I've read a lot of the books that you've written, and I know you've also illustrated a ton for many, many great authors. But your stories, especially when I'm reading Pedro here, you've got such beautiful text, and I love the way that you sort of end up writing in stanzas of sort of free verse poetry. I guess that's the way that I look at your writing, specifically in Pedro, that it's just it's beautiful, and it's carefully selected words, And I think that it, the way that you've styled the writing too, the way that it's laid out on the page, just makes it approachable and makes it something that's really great to read aloud, but something that's also sort of beautiful to look at along with the illustrations.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. Yeah. That's something I think of as I'm writing. I need to think of how many words are going to be on each spread and how the words and the picture are going to fit together on the page. And actually writing in that style, it kind of helps me as I'm writing. It makes the whole thing seem less daunting. Like if I sit down and think like I'm going to write a book, it just seems like it's too much. But if I think, all right, today I'm going to write the scene where Pedro is sitting and watching Ramon play and he's feeling left out because he wants to play with the older kids. And it's sort of this one moment that I'm writing. And even within that, I'm writing, I need this line. And kind of once I have this line, I can work on the other lines and not worry about that first line. And sometimes I even write this way. Like I have a book I've been working on now that where I kind of wrote it in sort of that free verse poetry. But then I ended up combining them all. So it's not going to be like that in the book, but it kind of makes the writing process a little easier for me, I found.
Oh, that's great. It's great to picture that you weren't sort of writing this all out paragraph style and then breaking it up that way when you put it on the page.
Right? No.
That's the way you approached it.
And I try to see how it sounds when you read it aloud, too.
Yeah.
Like words have to – there has to be kind of a rhythm to it.
That's exactly what you accomplish when you write it this way. And that's the quality that I like so much about it.
Thank you.
I mean, to just read – do you mind if I read a page of your book?
Sure. Go ahead.
There's so much that I love about this, but I have this one marked. In the summer of 1998, on days when Pedro pitches, the streets of Boston buzz with anticipation. By game time, Fenway Park is packed. Fans wave Dominican flags and chant his name, Pedro, Pedro, Pedro. It's that, Matt. It's that quality right there to your writing.
Thank
that you. You're sort of instructing the person reading aloud, which I do have to say, I don't think everyone is a natural, talented person to read aloud books, but that's something that I think the story is owed someone who knows how to read it aloud. And you in this way are sort of giving an aid to the person reading too, that this is the way I want you to experience the pictures as we page as we turn the pages and reveal certain things. And as you know, as an artist, you know the way that our eyes will look over your illustration. You know that what will attract our eyes first, but also in the text here, then you're helping us to slow down in some ways and to take notice of certain beats in your writing and certain things you're trying to emphasize. And I think that is a quality that is so effective specifically in this story, but in your writing in general.
Thank you. Wow. Yeah. That's something I think about too. Like, I like short picture books, but there's something I think that's special about a book where there are enough words that you kind of have to slow down a little bit. And you have to take time on each spread where, you know, with some books, you know, even a wordless book, you could take forever looking at every picture, but I like that's something I think about the pacing. You know, when I'm writing a book, some spreads only have, you know, maybe 8 or 10 lines, and then some have a lot more, and it kind of controls how the pacing of the book goes when someone's reading it.
Yeah, I would agree. Hey, what did it look like for you to sort of build this book? You said something earlier that made me almost think you started with illustrations and then figured out what words you would have to write with them. But what did, particularly with Growing Up Pedro, what did constructing that book look like?
I mostly start with words, but I also start with the overall structure of the book. Like for this one, I pretty much knew it was probably going to be a 40-page picture book. You know, this is the fourth one of these picture book baseball biographies I've done. So it was kind of sticking to that format. So one of the first things I do is I kind of go through each spread figuring, you know, page one will be some opening image, 2, 3 will be the title page, you know, the 40 will be the bibliography, you know, 38, 39 is the stats and the author's note. And then I kind of figure out how many spreads I have to work with, what I want to accomplish. So I kind of map it all out that way first, sort of like a storyboard. But even at first, the storyboard isn't pictures. It's kind of like I just write as few words as possible of what's going to happen on each page. And then it's kind of like divide and conquer and trying to write each page. And every now and then I'll kind of get in the groove with one page and it'll flow right into the next one. But sometimes I'll get stuck and I'll just jump to a different part of the story. And it kind of build up the whole thing. But then I'll write everything and then get into the rough sketches. And then usually once I figure out what the sketches are going to be, I go back into the words and usually get rid of a bunch of words because yeah. I figure out which parts of the story are going to be told with pictures and which words I don't really need. So there's a lot of back and forth.
Yeah.
And then the end, you know, the last 6 months or so is just painting, just sitting at my drawing table and getting all the final art done. You know, that takes most of the time.
I okay, here it comes. I warned you the fan stuff is going to
All right. I'm prepared.
There's a lot of things that you do so well, but there are two things that I think you do better than most people out there in the illustration world. And that is your control of the environment. And I mean in the way that your lighting and your the way that weather plays into a lot of these stories and time of day and things like that, and the way you're able to convey convey weather as a character, and also the way that you illustrate people is so spot on, is so in some cases it looks like you're working straight from pictures all the time and you're just translating a photo into an illustration, but I know that's not the case. I just know you have such a good control of the way that you know the human form and the human form in action, because you're not at all just relying on here's a standing pose here and now they're standing with their kids, now they're standing yeah. holding a baseball. But every illustration that I've seen you do, and I've seen almost everything, I feel like, has characters in motion, has people in motion. There's nothing really stagnant about any of the components of your art. It makes it beautiful and it makes it sort of life capturing, Matt. And it's amazing. I love and respect so much what you do.
Thank you. I don't know what to say.
Take it in and tell me that you're real.
That's nice to hear. I mean, it's all stuff that I work at and try to keep getting better at. And I feel like I look at a lot of my artwork and feel like I could have done better with a lot of that stuff. And I'll notice a face that looks a little overworked and a pose that looks a little stiff or something like that. And, you know, I don't get it right every time, but that's what I try to do, you know. In a book like this, I try to, like, capture Pedro's mannerisms and you know, watch a lot of his games and just see how he moves and see, you know, not just his pitching motion, but just his looks on his face and all that stuff, and try to capture everything I can.
What I see specifically in the art you created in Pedro is that I see the way that a kid would watch a baseball game and then run outside and play that game, want to recreate that game, like yeah. Sandlot style, right? I see, or the way that a young artist would want to look at your art and try to draw the way you draw.
Yeah.
Because all kids do that too. I look here at Pedro and look at the way that it's a study in the human form, and look at the way, I mean, just on the cover, the way that Pedro's 1 foot when he's pulling back to pitch the ball, it looks like it's all the way up to his waist. And to think that's really, if you were to study that pose and then try to get in that pose as a kid is developing what it's like to, I don't know, to be pitching like Pedro. I mean, that's, they are studying now your book then,
yeah,
to be able to become Pedro. And that's really amazing.
There's one thing in the, that I've heard a lot that I love is that there's this one page in the book where I show his hand grips, like how he grips fastball, the curveball, the changeup. And I've heard a lot of people saying, you know, my kid ran right outside and tried to throw the three different pitches. And it's not as easy as, you know, just holding the hand that way, but it's kind of cool that kids can look at how Pedro, you know, how he threw that circle changeup and run outside and try to do it.
Right. And also then look at the way that it, and I know you know this, but the emphasis it puts on you as an artist needing, and as a storyteller, needing to get this right. You have to be accurate in your
right
books, in the text and in every mannerism of the illustration, because the kids are going to study it. And if something is amiss, if these kids are fans of Pedro or fans of baseball or fans of whatever the content is that you're illustrating in your work, if something is amiss, then they won't be there in the story with you. It takes them out of it.
Right.
So getting that right is so important.
That's definitely one of the stressful things about making nonfiction books, is just, you know, your readers are kind of just trusting you to be telling the truth about everything. And, you know, you need to just make sure you get everything right. You know, I definitely have times when I'm working on a book that I wake up in the middle of the night and think of something that I think is wrong. And I have to, you know, go check and make sure, you know, every little detail has to be, I want everything to be accurate. And, yeah, because people are just trusting you that it's true.
Right.
And I, you know, or even worse, with, especially with baseball books, there are always, you know, hardcore baseball fans that are going to find every, if I messed up on some little detail, someone's going to email me about it and point it out. It's like,
it.
Oh, yeah, that's happened a couple of times, not too often, but there's always some know-it-all. But I try, you know, I try my best to get everything as accurate as I possibly can.
Well, you're right. There's always going to be someone that is just looking for the mistakes and that they can't just sit back and enjoy it. But for those that can just marvel at how right, how well studied you did get it and you did pull it off. That's a good thing. And that's a cool thing for you to be able to experience that and to hear those stories coming back of, oh, my kids saw the grips that Pedro had and ran out and tried to do it themselves.
Yep, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. So you work exclusively with Candlewick. Am I right about that?
Yeah, mostly. I've done a couple books with Disney Hyperion. I did Hell in a Big World and Jack's Path of Courage, two biographies written by Doreen Rappaport that I illustrated. But yeah, I've done a bunch of books with Candlewick, and I have a few more in the works. So yeah, they're kind of, I feel like I've grown up with them. You know, I my first book with them came out in 2000, Zachary's Ball.
Yeah.
So they're kind of like my family.
How is that developing a relationship with a publisher? Is that Candlewick is one, there are maybe two publishers that I could name that I hear over and over that authors and illustrators alike form relationships with and then tend to sort of be part of that family. And that's why I was connecting you with Candlewick, because so much of it has come from them, which I think is amazing. I mean, I think that it should be like that. It should be like a family.
Yeah.
It should be someone that you can grow up with and they can know your stuff. But are you able to share when that relationship became so, I don't know when you knew it would become so long-standing, or is it always just book by book? I feel like it's not, though. I feel like they're family.
I mean, I guess at first I didn't know, you know, I did that first book. You know, my first book was actually my senior thesis in college.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so I'd done the whole book as this school project. And then after graduating, I found an agent who liked it, my agent Rosemary Stimola. And then she found Candlewick, and they liked it, and all this amazing stuff was happening really quickly. But at that point, I had never written like another children's book. It was just this one I made as my senior project. So I had that first book, and it was, this amazing, you know, learning process to start working with an editor and an art director. And we pretty much rebuilt the entire book from scratch and treated that college project as the rough draft. Yeah. And I did everything over, and they were amazing. Like, and I think I was really lucky that I happened to live about 2 miles from their office.
Oh.
Time. So I would go in every few weeks and show what I've been working on and get feedback and redo things. And I felt like that was, like, I never had classes in how to make picture books. And I feel like making that book was like my crash course in how to make a picture book. And I would go to these meetings and try to like act like I knew what I was doing, because they were paying me money to make a book. And I didn't want to let them know how little I knew. You know, I was confident that I knew how to draw, but I hadn't really even thought about a lot of the, you know, the things like page turns and telling stories with the pictures and not just in the words and things like that. But that first book, you know, was a whole great process, but then I didn't know what was going to happen next. And they made it clear, like, they really wanted to keep making books with me, and my editor was going to work on finding something for me to illustrate, and I was working on finding something for me to, you know, I was trying to write new stories. And but right at first, I didn't know if it was, you know, what if I just wrote this one book and it was this fluke thing that happened?
Oh, no.
But then I had another and another, and before long, it just kind of developed into this this great situation where I have people that I've worked with for a long time who I love working with, and it's really been a great thing for me. I feel like I really lucked out finding them when I did too, just because I've, you know, I learned so much back then. You know, when I was 22 and working on that first book, it was like,
oh man.
I think even if they had been in New York and I was living in the Boston area, it would have been different. But I got to go have all these face-to-face meetings, and got to learn so much from these people who had been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, to see your stuff come up over and over with Doreen Rappaport is something special, to see that you like you're saying, that you have gotten to publish a couple books with
yep.
some of these similar people. And it is great to see, too, in the time you've spent in illustration, that, I don't know, when I'm looking at it as a librarian, as a person that loves reading books, as just a fan, it's cool to see that the work that you get illustrating other people's stories feels like books that you would do. And it feels like you can almost tell when, you know that authors don't get a whole lot of say in who that will illustrate their book, but that you rely on the publisher to figure out who that would be. But it just feels like, oh, yeah, well, they knew, mm-hmm. well, this is a book that focuses on people and needs this kind of a big setting, and so we got to call in Matt. He's going to be the right guy for this.
The one thing too that I'm pretty grateful for to Candlewick is they've trusted me with different kinds of books, which has really let me kind of grow as an artist and do things that I wouldn't have thought to do on my own. Like, I mean, I did a couple fairy tales.
Doing the Gingerbread Pirates, right?
Yeah, and then that. Yeah, like that was the crazy thing too. Like, I did these two fairy tales, and then they sent me Lady Liberty by Doreen Rappaport, which was nonfiction. That was the first nonfiction book I did. Just tons of research. Like, that was the hardest book I've ever illustrated.
Really?
And then right from that, I went into the Gingerbread Pirates.
That's totally different.
It's just like, all my characters are cookies, and I'm like, all of a sudden, I have to, like, figure out, you know, how to make these cookies. How do they move, and how do they show emotions on their faces? And it's like, all of a sudden, I'm just so out of my element trying to figure all this stuff out. Where I
kind of cool to go from one giant statue that can't move, but you have to sort of convey a sense of movement to cookies, which is, gingerbread cookies aren't known per se for movement. And this one, Gingerbread Pirates, has one with a peg leg, for Pete's sake.
When I was working on Lady Liberty, I kept like dreaming of the day I could just be working on the Gingerbread Pirates, because I thought it would be so easy. Like, there's no research, there's like no human character, like barely, there's a couple scenes with human characters, but mostly just cookies. But then, you know, once I got into it, it was like, how do I convey emotion on this face when I just have frosting and candy? it's like, it was so hard, but it was great for me to be able to try those different things and not be kind of pigeonholed into doing just a certain kind of book. And that's all, I mean, they trusted me with these very, very different types of projects.
Yeah, well, it certainly has paid off. I mean, for them to trust you with that, and then for you then to be able to diversify the work that you've done, I think only leads to more work and more, you know, cool new things you get to try out.
Yep, absolutely.
I love in examining your art that you are so consistent too with mixing up the sort of the shots that we get to see. The way that there are times when you pull back and we see this massive city view, or just, I don't know, just tons of stuff to see. And then there are times when we are really intimate with the figures. I mean, just leafing through Lady Liberty, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of these great shots with different perspectives. There's times when we're close up on the character.
Yep.
There's just a lot that is, I guess the way I would say it is just that there's a lot that's interesting to look at and new to look at. It's not like I'm seeing the same, oh, well, here I have a close-up of this dude's face, and now I have a girl's face.
Right.
Lady Liberty's face. No, it's just constantly like the way that a good film is shot. It's playing into where do I need the eyes to focus, and where do I need, well, really the reader and the story to focus.
Well, that was one book that, I mean, I could show you piles and piles of sketches that just weren't right, that I kept going back and doing over. And it was really challenging just because the way Doreen Rappaport wrote it, it felt very personal. Like, it's all present tense, first person,
right.
But it's this subject matter that's so huge and monumental. So that took a while to try to capture both of those things. And some of that actually came from feedback that Doreen gave during the process. There was this one sketch that she just hated, and she like let the editor know and got back to me. And that was the first interaction we ever had, like, directly. So that was a sketch I went back and I was like, all right, I really got to nail this sketch. Like, I want to, you know, show that I can do this. And it was this one of Joseph Pulitzer, and I ended up doing this picture of him at his typewriter, and
I love that picture.
Yeah, it turned out to be like one of my favorite pictures in the book, and tried to capture, you know, that feeling like you're right there in his office, right next to him. And that sort of, once I did that sketch, it kind of made me rethink a bunch of the other sketches, trying to capture that, you know, that make it feel like you're there, which I do. I try to do in a lot of my pictures now, where I just try to imagine, like, if I was there in this scene, like, where would a really cool point of view be? Like, what if I was standing on the sidewalk right next to that guy? Or what if I was up, you know, on the 10th floor looking down? Or
yeah.
I try to just imagine that and then kind of play around with the points of view in my sketches.
Well, that picture with Joseph Pulitzer makes me feel like that's, if I was just a person witnessing the scene, I would want to be close enough to read what's on his typewriter, close enough to look
right
over his shoulder.
Yep.
Although I have to say, sometimes when I see your art that close, when you're that close on a person, I feel like you're showing off. Like, look how beautiful I can make these people look. I'm like, all right, Matt, we get it. You're good.
Yeah.
No, but that idea of getting the right picture is something that I think that makes a lot of sense, that trying to play around with different perspectives. And I imagine seeing all of your different attempts and, I don't know, being able to step back from all of it and try to figure out what is the best way to convey it, what's a new way of looking at it. I just love in that book too, and maybe I bring up Lady Liberty so much because it's a book I think a lot of us teachers use so much in our schools. It's one that gets circulated not only by kids, yeah, but also just by teachers. It's used a lot. I love in that book, I just can't think of any other books that do it, that you've got a page that flips up so that we see the Statue of Liberty, but we see her bronze.
Yeah.
So to see that picture, it's just not something that
kids are always fascinated by that.
Yeah, it looks like a penny.
Exactly.
Just,
yeah.
It looks wrong in that way, but it's not. And before that, before you lift the flap, and I'm just recalling because I'm looking at it here on my desk.
Yeah, good.
But to have that all of the flags, that it's the American flags and the French flags, mm-hmm. and just everything kind of enshrouded in fog, and seeing the flags waving and and the Statue of Liberty sort of peeking out from all of that, it's striking. And it's something that if any of us have been to the Statue of Liberty, that's something that you do see, and you do look up at her. And there is, I've been there one time, and I can tell you almost every single thing about that day. And that was, I think I was 9 years old when I went. It was a moment that it gives you this amazing sense of pride in our country and accomplishment in what we stand for. And so I think that's what I'm getting at too, Matt. When you painted this, that was something that not just with like talking about Pedro and how you have to get it right for the people that will look at it with a critical eye being fans of baseball, but here, this is a national symbol that you have to be able to convey the emotion and get it right, because that's something that we care about.
Right. Yeah.
You do though. So.
Yeah. I remember when I was working on Lady Liberty, I went to the statue a couple times, and my first visit there, I remember, like, you get off the ferry and you kind of walk down the sidewalk, and there are trees blocking your view of the statue. And then there's this point where you look to the right and you see the statue, and you're facing east. So it was just this, like, just even though you kind of know you're going to go see the Statue of Liberty, it's going to be really cool. But then to actually be there and see it in person, and the sun was rising, so it was just behind the statue. It was actually in front of the statue, but I was kind of standing behind the statue, and it was just such a powerful image. And I just took a picture right there, and that basically ended up being the first page of the book. Just that first view you see when you come to the island in the morning and see the Statue of Liberty today, just with the sun rising, sort of making the statue into a silhouette. So I tried to capture sort of the feeling of being there as best I could.
When you're doing research like that, how are you able to bring it back to your studio? Are you going there and doing sketches? Are you taking a lot of photographs? Are you, when you're crafting stuff like this, I'm sure you're looking at a lot of things. But in that way, what does your studio look like, you know, at present when you're working on something like this?
Mostly, if I go to a place for research, I just take a ton of pictures. And, I'll take notes, and I'll kind of soak in as much as I can. I'll take videos. Like for Growing Up Pedro, I went to the Dominican Republic. And it was sort of a family vacation / research trip where we got to go out into the countryside and see a lot of places that still look how they did when Pedro was a kid. So I just took a ton of pictures and talked to people and tried to just soak it in as much as I could. And then when I go back to my studio, I have all these memories that are fresh in my mind, and all these places I had just been that I want to put into the book. And it makes it all feel a lot more personal when I'm painting a scene, if I just was there. Mostly it's taking pictures. I don't usually sketch on site in places. It's just less efficient. I try to just snap as many pictures as I can while I'm there.
Well, I would imagine too, in you, like you were saying, the way that when you're illustrating, you're thinking about how do I want to portray this as someone from the, you said, I think someone from the 10th floor looking down, or someone up close, you're able to do that with your camera and then step back and see all of those things pretty immediately, pretty readily. That this is what it looks like from this vantage point, or from the perspective of a child, or from
And usually when I'm researching, like, I'll get pictures of a lot of stuff, but then I might have an idea for a sketch that's from a completely different point of view. Mm. So I can, there's always a lot of imagination involved, where the final image might be from some completely imagined point of view, but all the details in it, if it's a nonfiction book especially, I need to make sure are all accurate. So I have the images of what the houses looked like in the Dominican Republic, what the mango trees looked like, but I might end up painting them from a whole different scene. But I can use all those photographs just to make sure that I'm being accurate in all the details.
Yeah. So what are you working on now? I assume you probably have one, maybe getting ready to
Yep.
To go to final look, but you're also getting ready to start another project, or you're maybe midway through. What's going on in your studio now?
Yeah, I'm actually, I have one book that's totally done, which I think I can tell you about. It comes out in spring of 2016.
Okay.
And it's called Crossing Niagara. And it's about, it's a book I wrote and illustrated about this tightrope walker called the Great Blondin, who was, he was the first person to walk on a tightrope across Niagara Falls back in 1859. So it's, it was a really cool book to work on. You know, this was one where I went to Niagara Falls and, did my research there. And that was another experience that was, much more, I was surprised by how impressive it was. You know, like knowing you're going to Niagara Falls, it's going to be a big, amazing waterfall, but actually standing next to it, it was just incredible. You know, and we went out on the Maid of the Mist boat and got to see, you know, it was just really, really awesome. So
one of my favorite things about going to Niagara, or just something that has always stuck with me, and I've gone there three or four times, is not only the amazing power of that water.
Oh, it's incredible.
Falling. I mean, even now, I'm imagining how your art will look painting that, because I know, as I said, I feel like you're so good at conveying nature in that way. But knowing, too, that one of the walks that you can take, you know, you can do Maid of the Mist, and then further down you can see the rapids.
Yep.
And one of those spots, they've got a place where you can see, they've got sort of a chart of where the falls were 100 years ago or 200 years ago, and how just constant erosion because of the power of the falls has sort of moved the falls back. So to think, even causes me to think that when you're talking about any sort of historical accuracy when it comes to the falls, is that they just in that way, like the geography was just a little different.
Oh yeah,
50-100 years ago than it is now. And I don't know, that's just a fascinating thing to me when you're researching, that it's not certainly just the way that people look and dress and the way that vehicles look and things like that, but the actual nature, because of erosion, because of things like that, can just look different.
Right, and there are a couple spots in the waterfall where they've like redirected the water a little bit, and you know, there used to be water flowing down this, you know, part of Goat Island in the middle that they since have changed. So, you know, and unfortunately, I could find, you know, pretty good old photographs that show what it was like at the time. But yeah, it's just one more little detail you need to make sure you get right.
Yeah, but just it's cool though. Very cool. Now I'm imagining when you're out on your school visits, getting to show these kids all this amazing footage of Niagara. And
yeah, it's gonna be fun.
That's cool.
And now I'm working on a book about the first woman pilot. This woman, Sophie Blanchard, who was a hot air balloon pilot in France in the early 1800s. So
is that the one that you've also written?
No, that was written by a writer named Matthew Clark Smith. And that's with Candlewick, and that'll be 2017. So that's kind of early. I'm just doing sketches for that. That's going to be called Lighter Than Air.
Nice.
So I've got a few things in the works.
Man. Yeah, Matt Tavares, you got some good stuff in the works. And it looks like you're getting to do, again, like a lot of just different stories and looking at different things. I mean, if you're approaching it from that photographer's lens, it's just you've got so many different interesting things to look at, and I assume you've got those experiences where you just sort of think, oh, that'd be fun to paint, that'd be a fun thing to be able to do.
That's a fun thing about my job, you know. There's really no limit on what idea might end up turning into a book. You know, it could be the silliest little thing, or it could be Statue of Liberty, or it could be anything, you know.
Well, I look forward to your picture book about space aliens attacking the Earth. That'll be a fun one. Oh, maybe you'll do like War of the Worlds.
I've got an idea about that, but yeah. I have some ideas for books that are nothing like my books at all, and those are the ones that are kind of exciting me the most right now, just thinking of doing like these funny books. And, you know, sometimes when I'm in the thick of doing a nonfiction book, like the thought of just doing like a really minimal kind of silly book intrigues me. I mean, I don't know if I can do that, but the thought of trying to do that is exciting.
You just try. You've got your whole career ahead of you.
Why not, right?
Yeah. No doubt. Matt, I'm excited that you've got the career ahead of you, because I love what you've done already. Before you go, I'm going to ask you a question about kickball. I know baseball is your sport, but I you know, you're an East Coast guy. I'm sure you grew up playing a little bit of kickball.
Oh, right? Sure. They're very similar sports.
No doubt they are.
The bases. And, yeah.
And they've got sort of the same thing that they've got the same nostalgia elements to all of the things. People talk about the mitt they've had since, and the glove they've had since they were a kid, and the yep. smell of it and whatever. And there's a thing about that red kickball that we,
oh yeah,
whether it's when it was chucked in our faces during dodgeball at school, or if we remember the feel of it out on the field, there's certainly yep. a thing that is evocative about it.
Absolutely.
So here we are. I'm assembling an all-star kidlit dream team kickball tournament. And Matt Tavares, I want to know what one person you want on your team, alive or past, from the kidlit world, and why.
All right, so the one person that I kept coming back to is Phil Bildner. Do you know Phil?
I know Phil. He's coming on the podcast to talk about his new book.
Oh, awesome. Oh, yeah. He's a good friend of mine. And
oh, cool.
He, I just think, would be awesome on a kickball team. Like, he's just full of positive energy, and he has this great positive attitude, and he's very versatile. He has all these great sports books, so I know he's into sports.
Cool.
He'd be good at kickball. And, he's got the Slugger series he did with Lauren Long and some picture books, some YA. So I feel like that versatility would translate to the kickball field. He'd probably be a good fielder, good hitter. And, I think he'd just be a good person to have on your team. And he was a teacher for a long time. So I bet he has played kickball.
No doubt. He's probably pitched for a couple of games.
Sure.
Too.
Sure. So
nice.
I think he'd be a good guy to have.
Well, Matt, it was a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thank you for not only the great work that you're doing and the way that you're inspiring our children and sharing these stories and this beautiful art, but just for giving me a chance to be a fan. I really love what you do, and I really am excited about what you're working on and what's going to be coming out in the future. You're quite a treasure when it comes to children's literature and sharing these stories, and so I'm glad that you're around.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for sharing my books and all the books you're sharing with your students and all your listeners and everything you're doing. I really appreciate it.
Like what you hear? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Leave a comment on the blog at lgbpodcast.blogspot.com or rate Let's Get Busy on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook, Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.